Have we started the tape?
We do not yet have a quorum, but I'd like you to begin to present your bill, Senator Eakin. This is Senate File 493.
And Madam Chair, and so I guess the motion would be to lay this over for, or is this moving separately?
Is this to be, is there a financial? It just goes to finance? Goes to finance.
Senator, can we understand that this can go directly to the floor unless somebody has some other interest in the bill and indicates that to us?
Okay, great. So, again, yeah, I'd make the. I'd like if somebody could make the motion to.
Madam Chair, I will.
Senator Rosen moves Senate File 493.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Rosen. And this bill actually corrects something that took place last year. There was a. A bill that was passed last year, a statute number 144.1225 that establishes a new requirement for accreditation of diagnostic imaging services effective August 1st of this year. And the law specifies four accreditation organizations that can be used for this purpose, one of which is any organization designated by the Secretary of the United States Department of Health and Human Services. And at the time this bill was being debated, it was believed that that the Minnesota Department of Health would have been one of those that would have been accredited by the U.S. Department of Health, and that small rural hospitals would were assured that Medicare certification through the Department of Health would be sufficient to meet the intent of this new state law. But the Minnesota Department of Health has indicated that. As the law is currently written, the department does not qualify as an approved, accredited organization for the purposes of this law. And to comply, all Minnesota hospitals now would need to obtain accreditation from either the Joint Commission or the American College of Radiology or the Intersocietal Accreditation Commission for the CT, MRI, PET scan, and the nuclear medicine programs. And so this has posed a real problem for the smaller hospitals in our state, the more rural hospitals in particular. And I believe in your packet there are a list of the hospitals that would be affected by this. For the larger hospitals in our state, this is a non-issue because many are already accredited by the Joint Commission, by one of the Joint Commission options. However, the Joint Commission process is not cost-effective for many of the small rural hospitals. And what we're trying to do here, I've heard a lot from a number of smaller hospitals in our district that and around my district that were worried that this law would negatively impact their ability to continue providing diagnostic imaging services to patients in their area. There are other testifiers here today as well representing some of those hospitals who will be able to speak to the specific challenges of accreditation. But what we're trying to do with Senate File 493 is to exempt the licensed hospitals from the accreditation requirements established in the statute of last year, requiring accreditation for facilities offering imaging services in an outpatient setting is sound policy because that's where they get their accreditation from. But for these small rural hospitals, they've been getting accredited through the Department of Health. So requiring them to go to this other accreditation process would be redundant, costly, and could lead to some of these hospitals not being able to provide the diagnostic imaging services that their patients need. With that, I guess I would like to introduce two testifiers who would like to testify to the specific problems that they're facing as a result of this. And again, I think it's important to note that last year when this statute was put in place, when it was passed, it was passed not with the intention of putting these hospitals through this added redundant burden of going through another accreditation process. As I said, the Minnesota Department of Health is already doing this, so there's really no need for it. So with that, I'd like to introduce Jerry Burmeister from the Windham Area Hospital, and Rick Ash will also speak from the Ortonville Area Health Services.
Welcome. Ms. Burmeister, are you wanting to present to the committee first?
I would like to, please.
Please introduce yourself then for the record, and you can begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jerry Burmeister, and I'm the administrator at Windham Area Hospital. We are a 25-bed critical access hospital in southwest Minnesota. We currently provide MRI, CT scan, and nuclear medicine services that would be impacted by the existing accreditation requirements in statute. We support exempting licensed hospitals from this accreditation requirement for several reasons. Applying the accreditation requirement to hospitals is redundant. Like almost all hospitals in the state, Windham Area Hospital is Medicare certified, and in-house CT services provided by our facility are subject to survey and inspection by the Minnesota Department of Health. Windham Area Hospital contracts with Sanford Health to provide mobile MRI services and DMS to provide nuclear medicine services. Both Sanford and DMS mobile units are Joint Commission accredited, which would fulfill the requirements of the law. However, since the law applies to the billing entity, Windham Area Hospital would have to obtain its own accreditation for each mobile unit that provides medical services at our facility. There may be a delay in our facility's ability to obtain accreditation depending on our actual volumes in the coming months. For example, ACR certification for CT scan services requires submission of 3 sample image packages comprised of a variety of different scans from local patients within a defined time period. As a small hospital with lower volumes relative to that of a larger facility, we have had months where our volume of scans provided to patients would not have been sufficient to allow for ACR to review, delaying our accreditation and disrupting our ability to offer continuous service to our patients. We would be required to accredit each mobile imaging truck as opposed to each service. In our arrangements, we would have to accredit 2 MRI trucks and at least 5 nuclear imaging trucks. This adds an administrative burden and additional cost per unit. I can give you an example. We can have, for instance, the MRI truck come to Windham, do their scans, and we would have to accredit that truck. That same accredited truck could drive down the road to Worthington, Minnesota, or to Jackson, Minnesota, and that facility would also have to accredit that same identical truck and staff that are offering those services. I want to stress that we're not asking to be relieved of all oversight of the diagnostic imaging services that we provide. Rather, that the Minnesota Department of Health certification process for Medicare conditions of participation for hospitals like Windham Area Hospital is sufficient oversight. I would also point out that we have arrangements with a physicist to evaluate all of our radiation-producing equipment annually to enhance patient safety. Subsequent accreditation through another organization is unnecessary and may jeopardize access to these services for patients in rural areas, forcing our population to seek services some distance away from Windham, or perhaps the patient may choose to elect to forego the procedure. I encourage you to support Senate File 493, and I'm willing to stand for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Burmeister. Mr. Ash, would you like to present at this time?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee for taking the time today to hear us, and, of course, for the work that you do. My name is Rick Ash. I am the administrator at Ortonville Area Health Services. We are a city-owned local health system. We have a 25-bed critical access hospital, a 64-bed nursing home. We have a small provider-based clinic and a small rural home health agency. So we're a very small rural health system. We are located on the west coast of Minnesota. As a rural integrated health care provider, we serve the needs of our patients in our community in a variety of services. Obviously, today we're here to talk about CT scans, MRIs, nuclear medicine, and PET scans, the major diagnostic issues before us. During last year's legislative session, we monitored the bill that established these accreditation requirements through our staff that were watching this. And at the time, our staff received multiple assurances from both proponents and the bill's author that these new requirements were intended to cover non-hospital operators during imaging services. As such, we had no evidence that we needed to step up and explain our situation. We didn't feel that we were going to be impacted. Excuse me. I cannot express how surprised we were when we learned last November that, as the law currently stands, these accreditation requirements now do apply to hospitals. As Jerry had mentioned, the accreditation requirements are redundant. We are already getting surveyed by the Department of Health. We already have physicists coming in annually to check the machines. We have biomed coming in twice a year, plus we have monthly PMs. Our technicians are tested for competencies. Prior to this legislation last year, we felt that our systems were very safe. So that being the case, of course, the CT scans that we provide to our patients are we use in-house equipment. We contract for with mobile units, as Jerry had mentioned, for the other services. We currently are working with Shared Medical Services and CentraCare to provide the other imaging services. Both Shared Medical and CentraCare are already accredited by the Joint Commission, so those units are already checked, verified, and certified. However, as you already heard, this law currently stands that we would have to obtain additional certification for each mobile unit that serves our patients to our facility. It adds costs. It adds complication, administrative burdens, and also the issue in many rural areas are low volumes. Every day, every week, every month is different for the people that come in our community for the needs that they have. And so those volumes can also create a complication if we have to do the accreditation, the duplicated piece of this. So while we do support advancing safety of our patients and improving the quality of care that we provide, we strongly support that. Last year's accreditation requirements do not advance the quality and safety in hospitals, and it only serves to lessen our ability to provide that care. So I just would ask that the committee strongly consider supporting this bill to allow us to go back to the prior to the legislation so that we can focus our energy, our resources, our staff, and the care we provide and towards taking care of patients as opposed to burdensome additional or duplicative accreditation. So with that, I would certainly answer any questions that the committee would have.
Thank you, Mr. Ash. Thank you for coming from Windham and Ortonville to come and all this way to talk about this problem for the rural hospitals. Do you have others that want to testify, Senator Eakin, that you know of as proponents of the bill?
I know that, Lori Massa is here as well, and I don't know if he wants to testify, but he's here for any questions, if anybody may have questions.
Thank you. If you will remain at the table, I would like to give the senators a chance to ask you questions if they have them. But I would just like to ask, is there anybody here that's wishing to testify against this bill? Is anybody here to express concerns about this bill? So seeing no one, then would the Senator Lori would like to ask a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Eakin, I received calls over the interim from several of my rural facilities as well with these same concerns, and I share them as well and really welcome. I'm a co-author on the bill and really glad that we're able to address it. I also had conversations with the Department of Health early on, but I'd just like for you to confirm that the Department of Health is okay with these changes and doesn't and believes that these would be duplicative, and that is correct, right? So this exemption for these facilities wouldn't create a situation that was problematic for the Department of Health.
Madam
Senator
Chair
Eakin.
And Senator Lori, they have taken a neutral position on the bill, so they are not opposing it.
Excellent.
Any other questions? Seeing no other questions, Senator Egan's not on the committee, so Senator Rosen,
yes. I'd like to move Senate File 493 be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion or sent to the floor.
It'll be consent directly to the floor. That's the motion. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Bill passes and moves to the Senate floor. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
A quorum is present. So that's why we could vote on your bill, Senator Eakin.
All right, thank you.
Senate File 459.
And, thank you.
Yes, yeah, Senator Eakin, you have testifiers that will probably be coming to the table, or are you going to present the bill first?
I do have testifiers coming to the table. And, Madam Chair, if somebody could move the bill to get it in front of us, I do have an amendment as well.
Senator Wicklund moves Senate File 459.
And I believe this bill was to be sent to state government.
That's correct.
Yep.
It'll be referred to state government. And I understand
Madam,
you have an amendment?
Madam Chair, I do have an amendment. And I would, well, we have the A2 amendment, which is author's amendment. And this is the first hearing for Senate File 459. So I'd like to offer this amendment just to get it in the shape and form.
Madam Chair.
That I would like.
Yes, Senator Rosen.
I so move the amendment.
Oh, you moved. I couldn't hear what you were saying. Sorry, Senator Rosen. So Senator Rosen moves the A2 amendment. Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The amendment passes. Senator Eakin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This and members, this Senate File 459 is a Department of Human Services bill. It's comprised of policy changes for the continuing care area of the department covering long-term care policy. The bill comprises technical and policy changes to nursing facilities, the disability waiver programs, and adult protection. And I have staff here from the department that will testify as to the contents of the bill, and Heidi Hamilton from the Department of Human Services will begin the testimony. So
you can begin. Ms. Hamilton, you begin. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Heidi Hamilton from the Disability Services Division at the Department of Human Services. I will walk through the sections of the bill related to disability services, and then I'll turn it over to my colleagues to present the other sections of the bill. I'll speak to the bill language and also what's been changed through the author's amendment. Starting with Section 1, this adds an exemption to the number of task forces that a state agency can create when the task force is mandated by a court order. Without this exception, the current language limits the commissioner to 4 task forces where members can have expenses paid to participate. An example of when this exception would be used is with the recent Jensen settlement, which required the formation of the Rule 40 Advisory Committee and the Olmstead Planning Committee. This means that 2 of the 4 task forces that the commissioner is allowed was required by a single settlement agreement. Moving on to Section 4, this section eliminates the requirement for the department to send mailings to recipients of medical assistance for employed persons with disabilities when they turn 63 or 64. Last session, the upper age limit for MAEPD was eliminated, so we no longer need to send letters to people who are 63 and 64. Also related to MAEPD, the author's amendment removes language that relates to eligibility for individuals turning 65 in 2012 or 2013. This language is effective January 1st, 2014, and so it's no longer necessary at that point. Section 5 corrects an outdated rule reference for authorization of private duty nursing services. Sections 6, 7, 9, 10, and 14 relate to the implementations of the MnChoices Comprehensive Assessment Tool. The changes include the elimination of the ability of lead agencies to contract with qualified certified assessors to conduct the assessments and reassessments, and also requiring the assessments and reassessments for the developmental disabilities waiver to be conducted by a certified assessor using the long-term care consultation. This brings this waiver in line with the other programs covered by the MnChoices Comprehensive Assessment. Sections 8 and 17 correct the placement of language that passed during 2012 regarding the ability for providers to provide input into the assessment process. The language last year was included in the statute specifically governing the programs, but we've moved it to the assessment statute, which is where it should go because that's the process that it involves. Section 15 adds child foster care to the definition of home and community-based settings where an individual who is receiving waiver services may reside. the language defining home and community-based settings passed last session, and child foster care was inadvertently left off the list. That's all for my part. I could turn it over to Greg Tabell unless there are any questions
for me. Are there any questions at the time? Sarah Neiman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Specific to the changes in Section 6 and Section 9, we've got some stricken language. Those are on page 17 and page 21. There's some stricken language on page 17, starting on line 17. And I believe a similar language is stricken in Section 9. With the removal of that language, does this prevent the county or whoever would be engaging in this? Would that, if they determined that the most efficient and effective method would be to contract with a certified assessor, that they would prohibit it from doing that, even if it was more effective and less costly?
Ms. Hamilton.
Madam Chair, Senator Nienau, that language would prohibit the counties from contracting with another entity to provide the assessments. We are implementing MnChoices under three currently approved Medicaid cost allocation plans for Medicaid administrative activities, for activities performed by counties, collaboratives, and tribes. As such, it covers staff costs as well as direct, indirect, and overhead costs applicable to the staff activity for these three entities. So because that is the method that we use for reimbursement, we are not allowed to, counties are not allowed to contract for the activity because those other entities would not be able to be reimbursed for performing the assessments.
Senator Nienau.
Madam Chair, my question is, why not change that so that they can be reimbursed if it's going to be, if there's a circumstance where it's more efficient and more effective, why prohibit that?
Ms. Hamilton.
Madam Chair, Senator Nienau, that is the method that's used to reimburse through medical assistance. If there were, if counties would choose to contract, then they would not be able to be paid for through the medical assistance system that we use.
If I could follow up, are you saying in the answer to the question that you'd have to change the medical assistance reimbursement language in order to achieve what Senator Nienau is talking about?
Madam Chair, we use a random moment time study through the medical assistance system that only we're able to reimburse the counties, the tribes, and the collaborations of counties. So there would have to be a different method that would be used to reimburse if we weren't using that system.
Is that a yes, that we would have to implement a change in the law in order to accomplish what Senator Nienau was talking about?
Madam Chair, yes.
Senator Nienau.
Madam Chair, and that was my question. Is this a state problem, or is this something that a federal problem that we're not able to change? So if we wanted to change, could we change and allow that? That's my question.
Please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, my name is Pam Merkel. I'm with the Department of Human Services, Disability Services Division. And Senator Nienau, this is our Medicaid-approved cost allocation plan. We would have to change that cost allocation plan. And I don't know that the federal government would allow that to occur. And the counties, while they could contract, would have to use other funding to, rather than Medicaid funding, to pay for that.
Ms. Urkel, does that mean that the counties could do that, but they'd have to find their own resources to pay for it?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
So the prohibition really is not to counties being able to do that. It's just that it wouldn't be reimbursed through this system.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Senator Nienau, and then Senator Nelson.
So it's not that there's a mandate from the federal government that prohibits that from happening. I want to make sure that I'm understanding this correctly. It's that the current agreement we have, which is approved by the federal government, doesn't allow for that. And if we were to get a future approval from the federal government, that would be possible if that change was approved by the federal government.
Ms. Urkel.
Madam Chair, Senator Nienau, we could request it. I don't know that we would guarantee to get it.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to continue along this line of trying to understand why it appears that we're taking away some flexibility from our local municipalities or counties, and my question is, what changed? In other words, the language that this bill is seeking to strike today, why was it okay yesterday? And now suddenly this language of, I would say, it appears to be more flexibility for our counties. Why does it need to be struck today? What happened?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, our min choice.
Mr. Urkel.
I'm sorry. Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, our new min choices assessment process is taking four current assessment processes and bringing them all together in a way that currently is done in four different ways by most often case manager services or public health nurses. And what we are doing here is separating the administrative functions of assessment and determining eligibility for public programs from the service of case management. And as such, we are paying for it in an administrative way rather than in a service as we do now. We should be paying for administrative functions as an administrative function. We pay for administrative functions through our Medicaid cost allocation plan that's approved by the federal government. We currently pay for these assessments via a variety of different ways, but for the most part, they're all service provisions of service, which is not the way you want to pay for an administrative activity.
Senator Nelson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Urkel, is it then a department decision that you're looking at consolidating four methods of payment in this particular Newman activities that you were describing? I mean, is this a department decision that has led to this need for this change?
Senator Ms. Urkel.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, this has been a department decision with the input of many, many stakeholders along the way that included the county, the counties, health plans, tribes, advocates. We've been moving towards our min choices assessment since 2009 when the legislature gave us the authority to develop the software and bring together these different assessment processes.
Senator Nelson.
Just thank you for your patience, Madam Chair. Just one more question. I want to make sure I understand correctly then. This is a decision by the department, but it has been approved by the counties. In other words, the counties advocated for this change that will no longer allow them to contract for their own assessments.
Ms. Urkel?
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, they have been with us in all of our work groups all along, and they know that this is the direction that we were going.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
There's a big difference between they know and they approve and that they support this. I'm trying to get at the nub of if they support this change.
Ms. Urkel.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, I believe that they support this change. They have some concerns, as we do, and we're working through them with them.
So, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
I'm hoping there are some testifiers from the counties then who are here today who can tell us what those concerns are, and if there are not, I'm asking that maybe this either be revisited, or is it headed to local gov next?
State and local government.
Okay, I just want to make sure that the public or that legislators have a chance to understand the significance of this change and how it affects our counties, and we certainly want to hear from our counties.
I know Senator Rose has a question, but before that, would you try to articulate for me as succinctly as you can the value of this change? What is it that is the increased value that's going to occur from your perspective with this change?
Madam Chair, can I ask a question? I just need to clarify. With the change in the assessment process or the change in the payment?
Both, I guess. They're related.
Madam Chair, the current assessment process processes that we have right now could have people who need services from long-term services and support in continuing care, going through multiple assessments based on what their diagnosis is and whether or not they might need a waiver service versus PCA services, they may end up going through multiple assessment processes at this point. So what we're trying to do is change this to be a more person-centered, strength-based assessment that it will include for the person that we're serving. It will include a look at all of the possible things that they might be eligible for, and then together with the certified assessor would be able to look at that summary of what they might be eligible for and make a determination of what will be in their best interest to support them in the community. So that's the advantage of the assessment process. The advantage of the payment process is to help the department and the state be able to tell the federal government what are we paying for in administrative activities to determine eligibility for programs under medical assistance, and what do we pay for, what should we be paying for as a service of case management within that same program. Right now, the payment for these services is wrapped up in case management services, is in allocation to through the nursing facilities, as administrative activity, and there's 15-minute increment. All these different types of service payments are wrap up this administrative activity, and we are trying to make sure that we can separate it out and tell the federal government what are we paying for administrative activities and what are we paying for as a service of case management.
Okay, thank you. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a very complicated, this whole thing is really complicated. And Ms. Urkel, I guess in order to separate it out, what is it, section 16 requires the county to use a standardized tool to input the maltreatment report. So do we need to make ensure that the counties have this new computerized system going forward, or is this just language that you're going to be able to recognize and get something going? I mean, I'm very confused about this.
Could you help me by directing me to what you're referencing?
Section 16, it says, requires the county to use a standardized tool to input a maltreatment report and requires the information entered by the county into the standardized tool to be accessible to DHS. So does this, two parts to the question, are we really getting at what we need, the information we need, and do we need to give the counties their funding so they can get their computer system up to where they can start talking to each other and they can talk to you better? It's a two-part question. And then I have another question, Madam Chair.
Ms. Circle, before you answer, that section of the bill has not yet been reviewed by the testifiers, Senator Rosen.
Okay.
So we only had a portion of the bill reviewed. So,
okay.
Mind holding your question until we review that.
Maybe I can formulate a little better. Section 12, have we gotten that far, too?
Did we do? Yes. Mm-hmm.
We have. Okay. So that eliminates any deadline extensions for nursing facilities to submit statistical and cost reports to DHS. So, Ms. Urkel, that obviously raises a red flag as far as eliminating some of the ability for these facilities to report what they need to report.
Section 12.
And I am, too, anxious to hear from the long-term care industry.
Is someone wishing to respond, Ms. Urkel?
Senator Sharon, and I'm sorry.
Senator Rosen?
Senator Rosen, mm-hmm. That is not something I can answer. I apologize.
Okay.
Greg can answer it.
We haven't covered Section 12 yet, Madam Chair.
Oh.
Tabell, Mr. Tabell, would you introduce yourself when you speak to the record, and then I could not hear your answer. Speak into your microphones, everybody.
My name is Greg Tavell. I'm with the Nursing Facility Rates and Policy Division. Madam Chair, we have not covered Section 12 of the bill yet.
Can you remind us which sections we have yet to cover?
Madam Chair, I only covered the sections that were related to disability services. So at this point, I've covered Section 1, Section 4, Section 5, Section 6, 7, 9, 10, 14, and 15.
Thank you.
Yep.
Thank you. Are there any questions on any of those sections? Okay, thank you, Ms. Hamilton. We will then move to Mr. Tabell, who will introduce himself and give us a frame of reference as to what you will be speaking to.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Greg Tabell with the Nursing Facility Rates and Policy Division. I'm going to start out with Section 2, which starts on page 2. This relates to the consolidation bill that was passed in 2011, allows nursing facilities to combine, close a facility, and get rate adjustments at a facility that remains open. When we started using this section of statute with a provider this year, we realized we did not have an effective date of the rate in the language, so we are adding an effective date starting on line 221. Next section I will cover is Section 3, which begins on page 3. It's a rather lengthy section. It has to do with resident relocation. The resident relocation law passed about a decade ago. It allows for an orderly transition when a nursing facility decides to completely close. The changes that we have here mostly relate to one of two things. There was a stakeholder group that included the trade associations, counties, nursing facilities, and the Ombudsman's Office, as well as the Department of Human Services. They met for about 8 months going over the resident relocation law, and a lot of the stuff in here relates to best practices that have been found when a facility decides to close. As I said, this law has been around for about 10 years. We've had many facilities use it, so that experience was brought to the table to develop some changes that work best on a closure. A lot of the other changes that are in here relate to aligning the Minnesota law with federal law. Another thing that is in here is you will see a lot of references to managed care organizations. They did not have a big role 10 years ago when the law was developed, and now they're a much bigger player, so they are also addressed in the law. On page 5, line 19, you'll see that there is a reference to a closing facility prohibiting the admission of new residents. That's something that is federal law. When a facility is completely closing, federal law prohibits the admission of any new residents to that facility. It does not apply to a partial close. If they're only closing part of their beds, then of course they're allowed to continue to have admissions. Page 6.
Excuse me, may I ask you, at this point that the facility is closing and they've determined a written notice that they are closing, are they obligated if they, they may not admit anybody after that point?
Madam Chair, that is correct. Once they have announced it, once they've gone through the planning process and announced their closure, at that point they can no longer admit a resident.
I would assume that closing a facility like this isn't decided on the day of the written notice, that there's a process that's been in place for some time that has drawn them to that conclusion. So residents that are admitted prior to that time, are they informed of the probable closing and that their stay may be disrupted? Do you know?
Madam Chair, the resident relocation law prevents anybody from saying anything about closing until there is a formal announcement. So everybody gets the information at the same time. There is a small irony in that if it's a county or city-owned facility, they have to have public meetings. So if they talk about the closure, it's at a public meeting. There's a contradiction between the two, one being you have to have an open meeting and one being you can't talk about it. So in that case, the word does get out ahead of time. But if it's a privately owned facility, nobody can say anything until that formal announcement is made, which is after the planning process occurs.
Senator Nelson.
Before we leave this section, could you explain to me on line 4.1, actually 4.2, what's the significance of closing a facility, but you're striking the language about delicensing or decertification of all beds within the facility? So I'm sure there's a clear answer here, but it looks like you're going to have licensed beds without any facility for them to be in. So I'm sure that's not the case. But what are you trying to do here? What's the point?
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, lines 4.1 and 4.2, all the definitions in this bill that are being changed came out of the best practices work that was developed by the stakeholder group. In a lot of places, it's getting rid of the word curtailment and reduction and change and making it closing. This does say that the closing means the cessation, which means they're closing permanently, and there's not going to be a partial, it's going to be a permanent closure of the facility. Does that answer your question?
Thank you. Senator Nelson, did you have a follow-up?
Well, I'm just curious. So in a sense, though, obviously if a facility's closed, there are not going to be any beds to be licensed.
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, that is correct.
And so, Madam Chair, it just appeared that you were striking the very language that would make sure there's no licensed beds in that closed facility. I'm just curious about the funding. That's all. I want to, as we look at numbers of beds and such, I'm just curious about the funding element of that. So I'm assuming if the facility's closed, there's no funding and there's no beds that are currently licensed.
Mr. Tabell.
Madam Chair and Senator Nelson, that is correct.
Yes, thank you. The language just didn't quite read that way. Thank you.
Please continue.
So, one.
Could you give me a sense of how much more time we'll need to present the bill?
Oh, not much longer. There's not a whole lot more to say about the resident relocation law. If there's any questions on this, we could move straight to that.
Seeing none, go ahead.
Okay. The next section I'm going to present is on page 24. It is section 11. And related to that, section 12. Nursing facilities must report their costs on an annual cost and statistical report once a year. The due date is January 15th, and statute allows for a 15-day extension if they file for that extension by December 15th. Well, just about every year, we got 375 facilities right now, and just about every year, 300-some facilities ask for the extension, and they get the extension. So we said, this is silly. Let's just get rid of the extension, make the due date 15 days later, and call it good. So that's what sections 11 and 12 are doing, getting rid of the extension and just moving the due date back 15 days.
Senator Laurie.
That sounds like a significant time savings. Can I get some savings in my budget?
Madam Chair and Senator Laurie, I don't think there's going to be a whole lot of savings there to show on a fiscal note.
Can't blame a guy for trying.
Madam Chair, Mayor,
Mr. Tabell, and if the extension isn't there and the person doesn't meet the deadline, what happens?
Off with their heads.
Madam Chair, pardon? If this passes,
off with their heads. Huh? That's Senator Marty for you, right? That's his approach.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, if a facility does miss all of its deadlines, there is, in statute, authority for us to reduce their payments by 15% until they get their report filed.
Okay. Thank you.
Moving on to page 26, section 13. This is the critical access nursing facility legislation that passed last year. The only change here is a bad cross-reference shown on lines 31 and 32 of page 26. The minimum threshold for projects is in subdivision 15. Finally, in the repealer section, section 17, item A is removing subdivision 8 of chapter 437. That's because in the resident relocation law, we are eliminating a subdivision that this subdivision references.
Thank you. And is there still another testifier, Ms. Shands?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Rachel Shands. I'm with the Department of Human Services, Aging and Adult Services Division, and I have just two sections to cover. First, I will direct your attention to the amendment, the A2 amendment. On the first page, we're adding Section 2 to the bill. This is a purely technical amendment, correcting a cross-reference to the section of statute that outlines an individual's appeal rights related to determination of nursing facility level of care, so purely technical. And then I will turn your attention to Section 16 of the actual bill, which starts on page 29. And this is our last section to review. Section 16 of the bill requires all county adult protection units to use a validated, structured decision-making tool in order to carry out work that is currently mandated by state law. When the county receives a report about potential maltreatment of a vulnerable adult who lives in the community, county adult protection units are responsible to investigate this report. Counties also provide necessary protective services to vulnerable adults who have been subject to maltreatment. A vulnerable adult is a person over the age of 18 who, because of a physical or mental disability or due to dependency on services, is vulnerable to maltreatment. In 2009, six Minnesota counties collaborated with the National Council on Crime and Delinquency to develop a structured decision-making tool for use by adult protection staff. The counties involved in this effort were Dakota, Hennepin, Olmsted, Ramsey, Steele, and Washington counties. Research supports the conclusion that for complex decisions, structured frameworks result in more reliable and accurate decisions than clinical judgment alone, even for highly skilled professionals. The structured decision-making tool is designed to reinforce the clinical judgment of adult protection workers along critical decision points of the assessment and investigative process. For example, after a county receives a report, the professionals must determine whether the adult that is the subject of the report meets the definition of a vulnerable adult. They also must determine whether the alleged action rises to the level of maltreatment, meaning abuse, neglect, or financial exploitation. The tool guides the professionals through key decision points and requires documentation of the rationale for the worker's decision. Use of the tool results in more reliable, consistent, and accurate decision-making throughout the adult protection investigative process. Counties support the use of this tool. The tool won the 2012 County Achievement Award from the Association of Minnesota Counties. The six counties that developed the tool have been using it for several years. In December of 2012, an in-person training was provided for all counties, and the tool became available for their use in January of 2013. As of February 1st of this year, 59 counties in total had implemented the tool on a voluntary basis. So again, this proposal requires that all counties use this tool in order to carry out their adult protection work. And with that, I will stand for any questions the committee may have.
Thank you, Ms. Shands. I think that Senator Rosen was asking before she left about whether or not, others can help me remember the essence, I think she was asking whether the technology is in the hands of the counties to be able to meet this portion of the subdivision 10 here that says the county is to provide information to the state as it's gathered from this tool. Senator Rosen, I think I'm trying to ask your question. You might be able to do a better job of it. But is the technology in the hands of the counties to be able to implement what's being required of them here?
Madam Chair, yes, it is. The counties have access to this web-based tool currently, right now as we speak, through a secure portal, so it is available to them at no cost.
Thank you. That's fine. Are there any other questions? Is there anyone here that wishes to testify to the bill that hasn't been identified yet? Okay, thank
Madam
you.
Chair?
Yes, Senator Rosen.
Seriously, nobody from the associations? That would could just...
Senator Rosen is asking that we check again to see whether or not anybody from the Association of Counties would like to speak to this issue. Appears not. Okay. All right. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I see in the Senate Council research here, under Section 3, the note says it removes language providing an allocation of $450 per bed from DHS to the counties for relocation costs. And I'm wondering if that's going back to the language I was questioning about the decertification of beds in 4.1 and 4.2. But my question is, explain to me what the counties will be losing in regards to the $450 per bed for relocation costs.
Mr. DeBell.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, the counties will not be out anything because that process has not been funded for 7 or 8 years. There was an original amount. There was an extension on the unspent funds for a while, and then that extension expired, so there is no money in that process anymore, and that's why Subdivision 11 is being stricken in Section 3.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Any further questions? Was it your motion, Senator Wicklund? Would you like to renew your motion?
I'd like to renew my motion to pass Senate file number 459 as amended.
As amended, Madam Chair. And referred to state government?
Madam Chair.
Just a moment. We'll finish the motion, then we'll have discussion.
Madam Chair. And referred to state government.
Thank you. There's a motion. Senator Niemann.
Madam Chair, what is the motion?
The motion is to pass. Could you not hear? Is that the?
I'm sorry, my microphone maybe I wasn't close enough to pass Senate File Number 459 as amended and refer to state and local government.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's why I wanted to clarify. Before that, I do have one amendment that, with apologies to Senator Eakin, not getting a chance to talk to you. I do have one amendment that I would like to offer before we do that.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would offer.
Is it an oral amendment or?
No, I do have it drafted. It's the A3 amendment. Everything except lines 1.2 and 1.23. And as that's being handed out, Madam Chair, I will, and again, apologies to Senator Eakin for not getting a chance to talk to you ahead of time. I just realized this bill was coming up yesterday and got this handed to me as I came into the committee late, and you were already at the table. This is an attempt to address an issue, and hopefully the department is still here and can come up and answer some questions. There was a concern by one of my local counties, particularly Chisago, or specifically Chisago County, that there was some change that was precipitated of some sort recently. And my staff and committee staff have spent the last couple of weeks trying to figure out what that might be relative to the long-term care consulting services. And we've not been able to really get an answer as to what changed, but Chisago County is telling me that it, as a result of whatever has changed, now they're going to be spending hundreds of thousands of dollars more on these long-term care consulting. And this, according to their understanding anyway, is that they're now having to do consulting that formerly was done by other counties. And that's what this amendment is trying to get at. And if the department could speak to that and do we have an answer yet as to what exactly might have precipitated that?
Thank you. I didn't understand that you were going to have an amendment. So if I may just for order here ask Senator Wicklund to withdraw her motion at this time so that we can consider this amendment.
So I withdraw.
Thank you very much. And so now we will consider the amendment. Would anybody like to speak to the amendment? Ms. Eakin? Or Senator, I'm saying the wrong name here. Urkel, Ms. Urkel.
Madam Chair and Senator Nino, what has changed was that with all the assessments coming under 256B.0911, which includes the disability, the developmental disability assessments, the county of financial responsibility has been responsible for long-term care consultations or at least DD screenings. The county of financial responsibility has been responsible for those, and the change is that once this comes under this particular statute for long-term care consultation, the county of where the person is located at the time of the assessment would be responsible for doing the assessment. And that's what changed, and that's what's precipitating this particular amendment.
Senator Nieman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And when was that change implemented?
Madam Chair and Senator Nienau, Min Choices has not come up yet, so the change has not been implemented. It will not be implemented until the Min Choices assessment is up and running.
Before you, we're a little confused about your amendment. Would you redefine what your amendment is here for us?
Madam Chair, the amendment is defining that the County of Fiscal Responsibility will continue to be responsible for providing the services that they are currently. That is the intent of the amendment. If Mr. LeBeca wants to speak to that and clarify more eloquently than I, he certainly is welcome to do that, Madam Chair.
Are you saying 1.2 and 1.23 are not included in the amendment?
That is correct, Madam Chair. I offered it minus those two. That was those related to an earlier question that I had, and those lines are not appropriate to address that issue.
Okay, thank you. Senator Nieman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then follow up on that, Min Choices, is that change in Min Choices, is that departmental policy or is that legislatively directed, specifically in statute?
Madam Chair, Senator Nienau.
Ms. Urkel.
The Min Choices assessment process, the legislature gave us authority to build Min Choices back in 2009. And change the long-term care consultation and put all these assessments together. So over the last couple of years, the last couple of legislative sessions, we have been progressing with the separation of the administrative activities and putting them under an assessment statute and separating out the service of case management and putting those definitions into the other various waiver and home care assessment statutes. So we've been doing this over the course of the last couple of years, preparing for Min Choices.
Madam Chair, so my question is specifically regarding the change from county fiscal responsibility to county of residence. Was that legislatively directed, or did the department decide that as a matter of policy?
Madam Chair and Senator Nienau, the department decided that, but we didn't decide it in isolation of discussion with counties or advocates or stakeholders.
Madam Chair,
Senator Nieman.
That's a significant policy change that probably should have been and probably should be discussed by this committee as well as state and local gov. Members, I'm going to move this amendment. I'm going to ask for a vote. I think this is a discussion that could be much more thoroughly vetted for state and local, in the state and local gov committee. I think this is something they absolutely should look at. I would welcome more discussion here if members would like. I would hope, and again, apologies to Senator Eakin, that I couldn't get this done and get in contact with you ahead of time. I wouldn't normally try to do this to you, but here we are.
Senator Eakin.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Nienau. And I would be open to, I think there's some further discussion that's needed here as well. And I would also like to hear more from the counties on this issue and dealing with Section 6 and 9, the issues that were raised earlier as well. So I guess I would be open to laying it over and having some further discussion before moving forward on it, if that would be.
Laying it over before we make a movement on the amendment. The alternative, of course, Senator Nieman, is to have you withdraw the amendment and have it to be discussed in state and local government and have a conversation between here and state and local government in order to address this issue, which I encourage you to have further conversation about.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and I will let you make the determination as to whether this rises to the level of something that merits more discussion in this committee. To me, it seems like it might, but I'm not the chair.
We can articulate. You can rise if you would like to articulate again what you think the issues are here at this level for discussion for a while on this amendment. But it doesn't necessarily mean we would have to make a motion to this. We could ask you to withdraw it and then allow for further conversation because state and local government clearly has an interest in what it is that you're describing here.
I'm sorry,
so
Madam
would
Chair.
You highlight what you're seeing that this committee should be focused on in relationship to this issue as it relates to policy?
Well, Madam Chair, if your initial inclination is that it doesn't rise to that level, I don't want to argue with you. I'm comfortable with going with that determination. And Senator Eakin, I don't want to bog down your bill. I mean, if you're telling me that this is something that you're absolutely wanting to have a discussion with it on in state and local government, then I'll withdraw the amendment, Madam Chair, and be pleased with the fact that I've initiated some discussion on the topic.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Thank you, Senator. Would you like to renew your motion?
Yes, I'll renew my motion to pass Senate file number 459 as amended and refer to state and local government.
That is the motion. Is there any further discussion? It's as amended, correct?
Yes.
All right, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion passes and it's referred. Thank you, Senator Eakin. We have Senate File 7 next on the agenda. Is Senator Latz in the room? He is. Okay, great. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Senator Latz. I'm going to have Senator Marty move Senate File 7.
Move Senate File 7 be recommended passed.
Thank you. I understand you have an amendment, Senator
Latz.
I do,
Madam Chair, an author's amendment, the A2 amendment.
That as
Excuse us for the delay. We're just to have a couple copies of the same thing, it looks like. So we'll begin. Would you prefer to wait for this to be distributed, or is it one that you could begin to describe without every committee member having?
Please, we can describe it before it's fully distributed. It is an author's
okay, great.
Amendment.
Thank you, Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. At this, and members, this bill provides better and more thorough background screening for persons who wish to be guardians and conservators. And it provides for some additional and more ongoing reporting requirements for those who are already appointed guardians or conservators by the court, so that their qualifications can be more readily reviewed. And in particular, so that those who, for one reason or another, have disqualifying backgrounds, they, when that is discovered, are either removed from that position or they are not granted the position of trust that a guardian or conservator has. So, and it also makes some fee changes to accommodate the additional work that's involved. So with that sort of setup, I guess if you have the amendment distributed, perhaps
we
can do that.
The A2 amendment has been
so moved.
Offered by Senator Rosen. Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Please proceed, Senator Latz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to ask Deputy Attorney General. Deputy Attorney General, I want to get the title right. David Voigt to give the committee the detailed description of the bill, but I do wish before I do that to note that the AARP is in support of this legislation as well, and I have a letter or a memorandum to that effect from them.
Mr. Voigt.
Madam Chair, the purpose of this bill is to provide more information and better information to the district court judges that are appointing guardians and conservators to look after the affairs and manage the money of vulnerable adults. The current law asks the courts to look at an applicant's criminal history every 5 years. And what this bill provides is for the court to look at more information that can better inform the court on the qualifications of the person to manage somebody else's money. It provides the court with information about things like civil judgments and bankruptcy. And in addition to having a background check that considers criminal history, the background check also looks into professional licenses, whether the applicant has ever held a professional license, and if they have they had negative consequences? And we're not talking about all professional licenses. We're talking about the types of professional licenses that relate to fiduciary duties, which is, of course, highly relevant to the qualifications of a guardian or conservator. We're talking about people who had law licenses, licensed accountants, a licensed psychologist, for example. The impetus for this bill, from the Attorney General's perspective, was a case that our office prosecuted down in Rice County. The defendant was Terry Hauge, and Ms. Hauge, back in the 1990s, was a licensed attorney. And she was suspended from the practice of law for mishandling cases and for lying to clients. You know, with that professional background alone, she probably wasn't the best candidate to be appointed by the court to handle somebody else's money. But that's exactly the profession that she went into. She became a professional court-appointed guardian, and she was involved in one of the largest companies in the state who provided those services. And once appointed, she proceeded to steal money from her clients. She drained the accounts of lots of clients. She was prosecuted in Hennepin County. She was prosecuted in Rice County. And we're talking about people who, for the most part, are living on probably less than $1,000 a month. They're living off their Social Security checks and whatever other government benefits they had. And they are not in a position to lose that money. And in addition to losing their money, she left some of them in very dangerous situations. There was one case in which Ms. Hauge drained the client's bank account, and by the time she was removed as the guardian, the social services worker found him living in an absolutely squalid apartment with no edible food. There was another instance in which one of her clients was released from emergency medical care and was in a town he didn't know, and she refused to give him any of his money. She instead left him in a motel room with no money for any food. The demographics in our country is changing. Our society is getting older, and as that happens, there are more and more people that are going to become unable to manage their own finances, and will turn to the courts to appoint somebody to do that. And as demographics change, it becomes all the more important to make sure that the people who are appointed by the courts to do that are the best, most highly qualified people. And as Senator Latz said, the bill does have the support of the AARP, and it's just a common sense measure for the courts to help make them the best appointments they can.
Thank you. Senator Latz, anything further?
No. Be happy to answer questions, Madam.
Do you know, are there others here that wish to testify on this bill?
I can tell you that Jerry Kerber from the Department of Human Services is here to answer questions as well, but they are supporting this legislation also.
Thank you, Senator. Are there any questions? Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Latz. And I'm going to become the – why do we have specific numbers person? I'm sorry I'm doing this again. The $25 or $22 per study for individual who has not lived outside Minnesota for 10 years and the $37 for individual who resided outside, is that specifically tied to a cost for accessing a database, or is that a number chosen by the department as covering these costs?
Mr. Voigt.
Mr. Voigt.
Madam Chair, Senator, the increase in fee, it came from the input from DHS. When they looked at the bill, they felt that a $2 increase would cover their costs of going to the different state Minnesota licensing agencies. And the $37, the increased cost for out of state, is because they would need to go to the equivalent agencies in whatever state the applicant had resided in. The intent all along was to fund these changes not by any increased cost to the government agency, but through the applicants.
And Senator Benson?
Madam Chair, I respect that very much. I just want to make sure we're covering the cost, but not codifying something that, you know, if the rates are going to change, we're stuck at $22. We'll have to come back and change it in statute again. But if the department says this covers their costs, I have no objection to it specifically. It was a point of curiosity, and I thank you for the clarification.
Thank you. Any other questions on this bill? I just have one question. The lawyer that you're referring to in your story, I'm assuming the problems that were created while practicing law were reviewed by the Professional Board of Responsibility?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Voigt.
Yes, they were, and in fact, she was her lawyer's license was suspended. The problem is when the court appointed her as a guardian, the background study only looked at criminal history. She wasn't convicted for offenses for those problems as an attorney, and so the court, when appointing her, didn't know that she had those problems.
So does that mean then, Mr. Voigt, that the role of guardian wasn't a function that she received as a result of her being a part of a firm for which she was working? She's an attorney working in a firm, I'm assuming, and she was, it was a firm that deals often with trying to do guardianships for and managing people's money, for which she was found having difficulty. But this becoming a guardian apparently was something quite outside of the law firm, and she wasn't referred to this position because of her relationship with the law firm?
Madam Chair,
no.
Her law practice was completely separate. After her license to practice law was suspended, she switched careers and became involved with a firm called Estate Resources, which provided the guardianship services.
Well, that just begs the question of whether or not that firm does a background check on the people that they're bringing in to. Are they liable in this situation as well? But this probably is not related to this bill, but I think that you bring up an issue of significant concern, and that is when somebody is vulnerable or dependent on somebody else, that they be trustworthy and reliable. So anything's like a firm that's bringing people in to be guardians, that's not doing a background check about the trustworthiness of those people, is of concern to me. So there may be another place where we need to take a look at an expectation or a requirement. Mr. Voigt?
Madam Chair, in this particular instance, I believe Ms. Hauge and another partner had formed the estate resources firm that provided the guardianship services, but the legislation does provide that the disclosure requirements also cover any employees of a firm that provides those services.
In this bill you're talking
in
about?
In this bill, yes.
Okay, thank you. Are there any further questions? Seeing none, Senator Marty is not here, so Senator Wicklund, would you renew the motion to pass Senate File Number 7
I renew
as
the
amended? And excuse me, go ahead.
Sorry. I renew the motion to pass Senate File Number 7 as amended and refer to
Judiciary. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes and referred to Judiciary, where you will be seeing this bill.
That's
so will
you,
I.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Are you ready, Senator Rosen? Thank you, Senator Rosen. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's good to be in front of you again. Senate File 373 is about extending the MA assistance coverage from to include psychologists, basically. Right now, that psychiatrists are covered. And as you know, we're giving a lot of attention to the mental health objective and trying to move that forward. And I think this is an extremely good way of using all of our available resources and making sure that we look at mental health and the coverage going forward in different ways and different avenues. And I do have two doctors here to testify, Dr. Stark and Dr. Garrett. But basically, it's really increasing the integrated care. And as you know, that is a really important phrase that we use now about making everything seamless. So I went to Wikipedia and looked up integrated care because I was kind of curious how it's perceived. I know what integrated care is, but in the dictionary, it's coordinated care, it's comprehensive care, seamless care, or transmural care. Integrated care may be seen as a response to the fragmented delivery of health and social services being an acknowledged problem in many health systems. So again, this bill is going to be looking at different ways and different degrees of working together. It also, you know, I just wanted to say that the comorbidity between mental health and substance abuse and chronic physical conditions is extremely high because 68% of adults with mental disorder have at least one general medical disorder. 29% of those with a medical disorder are reporting a mental health condition. And 70% of primary care visits have psychosocial drivers. So I think we do a very good job in this committee, in this state, at looking at and continuing to look at mental health as in a holistic kind of way, but including psychologists, in the MA reimbursement is very critical. So with me is Dr. Tricia Stark. She's a licensed psychologist from the Minneapolis area, and she has been working with this issue for a long time. Thank you, Dr. Stark.
Madam Chair, my name is Dr. Tricia Stark, and I'm a licensed psychologist. And I'm also the legislative chair for the Minnesota Psychological Association. This bill on the surface may appear to be just a request for payment, but it's much more. It's an instrument for change. It reflects the core of our society's demand for higher quality health care, with improved patient outcomes, greater efficiency, and improved quality of life. While it addresses mental health, it's mental health at the nexus with care for chronic illness. The bill creates one pathway to provide the integrated care that recognizes the needs of the whole person. And Senator Rosen mentioned the comorbidities. Mental health problems exacerbate the disability associated with physical disorders and complicate their management. Patients with such comorbidities consume high levels of medical care services and health care costs. The treatment of the whole patient with integrated care demonstrates improvement in outcomes and reduces utilization of health services. Patients need assistance in integrating healthy behaviors into their overall lifestyle so they can be successful in managing their health. There are several models of integrated care. One model is consultation, another model is co-location, and the third is to have a mental health professional integrated into the care team. This bill addresses the first model, the consultation model. And while having a mental health professional on the primary care team is sort of the gold standard, it's not really possible in all settings, especially in rural settings or, you know, as we make this transition to integrated care. New payment models are necessary to shift the face of healthcare delivery. Reimbursement for consultation for primary care providers and psychologists is a step in that direction. Not all patients are seen in big healthcare delivery systems and accountable care organizations with integrated access to health psychology. To reach the goals set out in health reform, changes in payment for different models of integration are needed. I've been privileged to work in three different kinds of integrated care settings in my career, including a consultation liaison team for adolescents with chronic and life-threatening illness, as a fully integrated member of a team serving individuals with cystic fibrosis, and meeting regularly with the community pediatrician to consult on common patients with ADHD. These experiences have shown me the power of consultation by mental health professionals in improving healthcare. We ask that you carefully consider supporting this bill as a vehicle to move important health reforms forward.
Thank you, Dr. Stark. Dr. Garrett?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Willie Garrett. I'm a licensed psychologist. I'm also a member of the Minnesota Psychological Association and the chair of the Rural and Greater Psychologist Division. In addition to that, I'm also the president of the Minnesota Association of Black Psychologists. And this becomes a much more critical issue for those psychologists who work in small communities who have limited resources have to be quite creative in their work. But there are also many situations where psychologists provide consultation for psychiatrists. In my career of 30 years, I've worked in three integrated care settings. And when working in those environments, I was providing consultation on a daily basis to physicians. And sometimes it was a simple question about whether a certain behavior was a sign of depression. But other times, it was a crisis situation that required up to an hour's worth of time without any sort of compensation for that time. In the communities of color, there is a need for culturally specific consultation, and that is more likely to come from a psychologist than from a psychiatrist, actually. In the state of Minnesota, there's a shortage of psychiatrists, and those communities that are in greater Minnesota may have psychologists and physicians, but no psychiatrists within 100 miles. And so it becomes necessary for consultation between those two professionals. What you find is that many of our patients have dual conditions. When you have a person with diabetes, there is a certain cost for treating that condition. But when you add diabetes with depression, then the costs can triple because a person who is depressed is just unable to mobilize the resources that they need internally to manage their care. I'm here to let you know that I support this bill and that it is a much more critical issue, again, for those psychologists who work in rural areas and in the inner city areas as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Garrett. Before our senators are going to ask you questions, I just want to check to see if there is anybody else here today that was hoping to testify on this bill. Seeing none, are there any questions? There's Senator Rosen, there's a technical oral amendment that Ms. White would like you to consider.
Madam Chair and Senators, on page 1, line 8, I would recommend that we strike the word psychiatric because a consultation will now be done by psychiatrists and psychologists.
Yeah. Yeah.
So 1.8, delete psychiatric.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
That's a great oral amendment. I'm embarrassed to say I didn't catch that. I so move.
Primary. But you want something in there, don't you?
No.
I have that saying, consultation to primary care practitioners.
Senator Rosen, there's a discussion about here at the table about this, so hold on just a second.
No problem.
Is there any discussion on the amendment, the oral amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? is there any further discussion or questions from members of the committee? Senator Rosen, perhaps there's somebody from the department that could better answer this question. I'm trying to understand, I'm trying to think about the conceptually what you're describing is offering for healthcare homes, for example, that don't have mental health advocates on the healthcare team to be able to access consultative services via the telephone. And right now, under the law, only psychiatry services are reimbursed via telephone. And so what this says is expand that via telephone, also psychological consultation from a psychologist could be added to that. And this will have to go to finance, obviously, because of the related fiscal note. But is there a reason why it was narrowed only to the physician-to-physician consultation?
Madam Chair, I will defer
Senator
to
Rosen.
Dr. Stark or Dr. Garrett, but I would assume it's just mental health has risen to a point where we need to utilize all the resources, and perhaps before psychiatry was just the particular mode, but we know that we have to give this more attention, and as Dr. Garrett said, psychiatrists, there is a shortage of them, so I believe this is another tool that we can provide in the working towards a more complete mental health picture is really important, but I will defer to either
Senator Rosen, I'm just curious to know why it was limited in the first place, because there could also be, especially with the shortage of psychiatry for consultation on medical purposes, there are other professionals, advanced practice nurses who specialize in this field and prescribe in this field, that could be added to this list. So I'm trying to understand if it was a financial containment that was occurring here or if there was some other reason why it was limited. And if there wasn't, is there a reason why we wouldn't
expand it.
Allow reimbursement for anybody that can provide the kind of consultation services that a healthcare home might want to see receive via the telephone?
Madam Chair, I will defer
Senator
to
Rosen.
Dr. Stark. She has the background.
Madam Chair,
Dr. Stark, excuse me.
My understanding is that this came about in response to the Diamond Project, so that psychiatrists could consult to primary care as more patients were being seen in primary care for depression, and that it was just that narrow thing. I don't know that it was meant to be exclusive, mm-hmm. but it just developed that way.
But, Madam Chair, your opinion of should it be expanded, I think that's probably, you know, something that we should keep looking at. I know that they have had a mental health legislative network that has worked with NAMI and Lutheran Social Services and social workers, and perhaps, this conversation will continue further. There will be a fiscal note on this, I'm sure. I haven't received one yet. So just
right, and I suspect the more you add, the more the fiscal note goes up. So, and I do remember the Diamond Project, and I do remember that the as we progressed, that was a conversation separate from healthcare homes and about coordinated and integrated care. It was about expanding the reach of psychiatric medications to persons with depression, recognizing depression early in the physicians, the family practice physicians' practice, and to not have to refer to specialties to be able to provide that beginning level of psychiatric intervention, medical intervention, at the clinic level. Now we're talking about something that's really broader than that. Ought we, as a part of the healthcare home concept, where clinics don't have access to have right in their team access to consultation services, that you'd be able to do this via the telephone. So I do think there is a larger question here about if we're going to do that, we're going to change this, who should be included in the expansion to give access to these clinics to all sorts of consultative services if they need them. But I'm not going to offer any amendment at this time, but maybe in Finance Committee.
Madam Chair?
Yes,
with your background, I think that's you eloquently say exactly what I'm trying to say, but perhaps we should take a look at that and perhaps even just get a fiscal note on broadening it. But there will be one for this, but perhaps looking at it in a larger scope and just seeing how much that's going to cost. If we're going to be very sincere about our mental health agenda and the big white board, perhaps. So, Madam Chair, this will go to
Senator Rosen. If we ask for a fiscal note as it is here, we'll only get a partial information. We won't get the other information.
Right.
If we change the language to include APRNs, for example, and they did a fiscal note, they would I think they would break that out, wouldn't they, to help us determine how much from psychology and how much from, or we could ask for that. Anyway, I don't want to slow this process down at this time. I just know that it's like Senator Benson's questions: is it going to come back again and then come back again, in terms of expanding the definition here of telephone consultative services?
Right.
That's the issue I'm raising here.
So, Madam Chair, do I need to do a little more work on this bill, perhaps?
Well, if you wouldn't mind, if you would step back and think about it a little bit, we could bring it right back up maybe in the next time we have a hearing as to whether or not we want to expand that now, because we can't get the fiscal note to measure it if we don't have it in your language.
Okay.
Would you be willing to do that?
Madam Chair, I absolutely would. So with that, I will continue some work and have Dr. Start and Dr. Garrett look into this, and I would like to lay Senate File 373 on the table.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you very
Thank
much,
you.
Senator Rosen. It's a good idea, so I'd like to make sure that it's as good as it can be. Thank you. All right. Thank you very much, Senator Rosen. Now Senator Wicklund is ready to present Senate File 442. Amendments here. And no testifiers. Welcome,
yes,
Senator Wicklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I am here today to present Senate File number 442. I do not have any testifiers, but I do have resources with me if there are questions. This bill is to reduce the number of members on the Minnesota State Council on Disability Board from 21 members to 17 members. Just as background, the Minnesota State Council on Disability Board was established in 1973, and it advises the governor, state agencies, the legislature, and the public on disability issues. The council currently has 17 members on the board. They're appointed by the governor, with each member serving a three-year term. Each member has a disability, has a family member with a disability, or works with people with disabilities. Council members are appointed from all economic development regions of the state. Meetings are held three or four times a year. and an annual cost is about $5,000 for a face-to-face meeting. The council reimburses council members for all actual and necessary expenses incurred, and also members may receive a per diem for full council meetings. So this is at the request of the board to reduce the number, to simply reduce the number from 21 to 17 in the statute.
Okay, thank you, Senator Wicklund. There isn't anybody here wishing to testify on the bill, unless someone would indicate that from the audience. Seeing no one, are there any questions? Senator Nienow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think you answered the one question that I did have, is what if we have an 18th or 19th member of the board, but you said there are only 17.
Correct. Madam Chair,
Senator Wicklund.
Correct. There are 17 members and have been. It's been stable at 17, and they feel that this number is the best number for their board, and so they'd like to have the number reduced officially.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Senator Nienow.
Just a comment, then, that this may be one of the only bills we see this year that actually makes government smaller, so I'm all for it.
And if Senator Lori were here, he would assume that we've booked in the forecast two extra members' costs and would want to know whether the cost savings were going to be showing up in his budget. Very good. Okay, any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in, this is referred to the floor. This is referred directly to the floor. So Senator Wicklund renews her
Madam
motion.
Chair,
yes,
can
Senator.
Put this to the consent calendar.
I suppose that we could move this
know.
To this consent calendar. I think that's a great suggestion. Thank you, Senator Benson. Senator Wicklund moves Senate File 442, and it should be moved to the consent calendar on the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes. Thank you. And seeing no further business, it is recommended pass, yes. No business before our committee, the meeting shall adjourn. Thank you very much for your attention.